want to make a few remarks in advance. I was asked, this talk or paper was written within the first few weeks of the Fukushima disaster. The occasion for it, I was asked to write a kind of preliminary analysis for Le Monde Diplomatique, which I started to do, and I've added a few things since that time, and I've had further thoughts about it, which I'll share with you. The thing that I want to really emphasize, there are a couple of things I really want to emphasize, is that the earthquake and the tsunami essentially what it showed again was an episode, by the way, that in many ways it bore some resemblance to the earlier episodes of Katrina in New Orleans, but obviously on a different scale. But what it showed was a kind of conjuncture or convergence whereby nature actually collides with history in such a way or such a manner to really overdetermine the latter, which is history. And so what you get is, and what the overdetermination does is it unveils the crevices, the fissures of a kind of vast unevenness, which the natural disaster, I said, made visible. An unevenness for a long time had been concealed by essentially historical narratives of the nation, as well as, and with it, of course, the complicity of a political class or political classes and the bankruptcy of a political order over which they presided. In Japan's remote past, I should say, or to begin with, occurrences brought on by nature, such as drought, pestilence, volcanic eruptions, shooting stars, earthquakes, and the appearance of foreigners were invariably read as signs of a leadership's moral failure. Because the social order was aligned with nature and thus obliged to mimic it, any divergence, as manifest, especially in a calamitous natural event, would be interpreted as a reminder of moral failure that would surely be followed by even worse catastrophes that would spell out the imminent collapse of a political regime. In the months since the massive earthquake that shook northeastern Japan and a titanic tsunami that swept over the unstable Sanriku coast, the identification of natural disaster as a sign of political failure seems more convincing to me, at least, more convincing now than at any time in Japan's modern history. In fact, an elderly woman who lives in central Tokyo ratified this traditional political wisdom, which she was quoted as saying that when a country's leaders are bad, natural disasters occur. So traumatizing an event immediately after immediately recalled the end of World War II by the current prime minister, the Tokyo earthquake and fires of 1923 that destroyed much of the city and took more than 140,000 lives, and nervous evocations of the more recent earthquake in Kobe in 1995 and the loss of something like over 6,000 lives and immense property damage. The event and its immediate aftermath inspired the governor of Tokyo, Ishihara Shintaro, to irresponsibly blurt out that the combined earthquake and tsunami represented what he called heaven's vengeance, that signified a divine judgment against the habits of, quote, selfishness, rampant materialism, and the worship of money that now should be used to sweep away the wayward style and put Japanese on a correct path. Not surprisingly, this recycling of an older plaint that was used to explain the 1923 earthquake as well. And I should add, just as a kind of footnote to this, that the Emperor Hirohito, in an act designed to escape the gallows, wrote in 1946 that the war was actually brought about by the moral laxness and excesses of the people who had been subdued by materialism and consumerism. Yet Ishihara's critique was actually an opportunistic, inasmuch as he was up for re-election, and he was reelected, and a self-serving attempt to shift responsibility away from the political leadership to the moral waywardness of the people. What unfortunately was swept away was an everyday life now displaced in the countless homeless survivors and the uncertain thousands who perished in the waters of the tsunami. What has been left behind is a legacy of emotional toll and its residue that is simply impossible to imagine, which makes Ishihara's callous insensitivity even more obscene. In the immediate afterlife of the earthquake, it soon became apparent that apart from the visible and incalculable damage to human life and property, killing untold thousands, still untallied, and sending over 400,000 inhabitants into homelessness, the far greater fear was the fate of nuclear energy installations in Fukushima, whose fail-safe mechanisms designed for such contingencies were overcome by the tsunami, and whose subsequent and steady release of radioactive elements into the soil and atmosphere have posed the prospect of greater and even more devastating threats to human life, an eventual outcome that is still unknown, even to today, or unforeseen in the immediate future. The head of Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, broke down in tears during a televised report to the nation that combined effusive apologies for the inconvenience caused by the disaster. Think of the wording, inconvenience. And an unintended disclosure that he and his company didn't know what they were doing. In a 2007 earthquake of lesser magnitude, 6.8, in western Japan, a large TEPCO nuclear facility incurred damage but luckily escaped more devastating damage, even though it was not designed to hold up to a quake of that size. More recent criticism has surfaced to suggest that the company executives took too much valuable time in deciding when to begin the operation of cooling down the reactors in fear of ruining them, even though they knew exactly what they were supposed to do in such an emergency. Much of the criticism of cleanup performance has come from the United States, and therefore recalls the older neo-colonial relationship established in the post-war period, whereby Japan submitted to client status of the American Imperium. The company, it should be pointed out, has been in charge of the rolling blackouts throughout the country and thus revealed the unstated and unexplained relationship between state and business, a cozy partnership that consumer groups had previously called into question. I should say that TEPCO, for those of you who might not know, is actually a creature of the Japanese bureaucracy itself and is able to navigate easily from public to private domains and back again. With the passing of each day, there was not only the recognition of increasing and spreading radioactivity, found first in leaf vegetables and milk and then in other things, but growing criticism from victims who clearly expressed distrust in what both the government and the company were saying about the current situation and its dangers, and what they were leaving out. Despite reassurances, opinion has swung to expressions of disbelief in declarations advising the safety in the food supply, usually supported by American assessments, that counsel caution. After announcing that levels of radioactivity in spinach were still at safe levels, one American researcher said he wouldn't eat it. Yet this chorus of distrust among the general populace toward government and the company existed well before the current crisis. Both had accumulated a well-documented history of denying either the occurrence of nuclear accidents in the past or the dangers they pose that has often bordered on criminality. TEPCO has a long history of recruiting unskilled contract workers, supplying them with inadequate protection for cleanup jobs, a policy of managerial incompetence and irresponsibility toward ordinary workers that still discloses both its low regard for regulations and the state's complicity. Moreover, the company has now virtually exhausted the supply of workers who have been assigned the task of cleaning up, many of whom are from the region and have lost relatives, usually volunteers given salary incentives. But it is the close relationship between the state and TEPCO and other major industries that is at the heart of the problem of recovery and offers little confidence that the partnership will be able to meet this daunting challenge. TEPCO itself is now near bankruptcy, or at least this is what we've been told, and there have been discussions of nationalizing the economy, which will never happen. It is clear that the state, using public funds, will have to bail the company out. At the same time that the government recommended that the contamination zone be extended first to 19 miles, and then God knows what it is, we've already had a report on that from the site, and advised those who live within it to remain in their homes for an indefinite duration in order to avoid exposure, it also knew that this voluntary internment contradicted the obvious fact that people would have to venture outdoors for water and food. It is, in fact, this kind of contradictory advice from state and company, its constant counseling of people to be patient without giving them useful information that would justify asking them to sacrifice, that has put the leadership of the political classes and its capacity to meet the current crisis into serious doubt. But again, the lowering of confidence in state, bureaucracy, and parties had begun long before the quake struck Northeast Japan. What the current crisis has dramatized was the decision to build a chain of nuclear plants along an unstable coastline already known for its reception to tsunami. I recall, actually, it's kind of ironic or paradoxical that they would have done this. There were any number of philosophers in the past, of course, who had boasted that the regular occurrence of earthquakes in Japan's history has become a constituent element in the building of a resilient national character. But the quake and tsunami delivered a devastating blow to a regional economy which had already lagged behind most of the country. This area had been less developed than other regions for historical reasons since the 19th century, and the decision to erect nuclear energy facilities along its coast was a measure dreamed up by the state and TEPCO to instill economic growth and prevent the out-migration of its population from the region to the proper urban south. As one TEPCO, one worker actually said, who is from the area, he says, we don't get electricity from these nuclear installations. They all go, it's all sent south. If the natural disaster has a long-term double blow to the regional economy, its impact on the global economy is just now beginning to be felt with perhaps even greater uncertainty concerning the future. Despite the paucity of reliable news getting out of Japan, it is evident that residents of the region are now beginning to compare the government's slow and unsteady response to bring aid and supplies to the affected area, to the earlier Kobe earthquake, where the state took several days, maybe close to a week, before even recognizing the severity of the event, and nearly a week before it began to send relief, prefiguring the delayed and inadequate response of the American government at the time of the Hurricane Katrina. It should be pointed out that during the Kobe earthquake, Japan refused offers of foreign assistance. In this most recent episode, it has only reluctantly and slowly begun to ask for foreign aid. The reason for this hesitant response of help suggests that the country didn't want to look like Haiti. While federal relief agencies of the American state proved as tardy and incompetent in its response, the indifference of the Bush administration to the most affected quarters of New Orleans, which were occupied by poor African Americans, matches the Japanese state's insensitivity to the fact that many of the homeless in Northeast Japan are old, infirmed, and without resources. Even though news reports dwell on the immediate needs of evacuees, it is clear for most Japanese the threat of radioactive contamination is actually at the heart of the critical outburst and constitutes the greater danger to both the general population and the political classes, as well as the system where, as Sabo points out, the apparatus over which it has continually presided ever since the early 1950s. What is so significant about this political failure of nerve is the unwillingness of the state to even mention the destruction inflicted by atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki during the war, and especially the massive death toll by radiation in the following years. And in this regard, I don't want to summarize this, but there are a number of writers critics like the writer Oe Kanzaburo, Murakami Ryu, who want to remind their country, Oe has been pretty consistent in his opposition to nuclear nuclear energy. But he feels that the event obliges people now to return to the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and keep faith with the dead in order to use the occasion to prevent the expansion of the nuclear industry. The first descriptions and aerial photographs of destruction in northeastern Japan closely resemble those from Hiroshima immediately after the blast. While the state has constantly reminded the population of the dangers of nuclear energy and radioactive contamination, it has been at the forefront of contributing to precisely its eventual realization. By the same measure, the Japanese since the 1950s have been disciplined into a political order which has emphasized hard work, uncomplaining sacrifice, and conformism, the values of sturdiness, loyalty, and acceptance, which paradoxically produced indifference to the oxymoronic figure of an unresponsive one-party democracy and profound distrust and criticism of its leadership. Hence, the criticism we see now surfacing in word and in deed reflect a deep collective unconsciousness of the fear of how easily radiation poisoning and its effects are contracted once it is released in the atmosphere. The evidence of this panic has appeared in wide-scale migrations from the area, despite government assurances of safety, especially from those regions outside the effective zone. Those that can't afford to leave are doing so, just like foreigners in the early days of the episode. Photographs of cars and long gas lines, trains filled to capacity, stations and airports bloated with waiting passengers tell the story of this migration as dramatically as the TEPCO executive who broke down in tears, or even the unprecedented appearance of the Heisei Emperor, Akihito, on television calling for his subjects to remain calm and hopeful that they will care for each other, but also reminding them of his father's, it's Hirohito, his father's radio broadcast to the nation in 1945, which announced the end of the war, asking the nation, and I'm quoting, to endure the unendurable now that he had brought the war to an end. The use of the emperor, and this is where I'll conclude, because I think it goes back to something that Goh had mentioned just in his concluding remarks, because I think it has a lot to do with these degrees of invisibility that exist in Japan. I think the use of the emperor at a moment of crisis compared to war's defeat was preceded, of course, by the Prime Minister Kan's announcement that the disaster was the greatest Japan had experienced since 1945. Despite the fact that this emperor, unlike his father, no longer claims divinity but only the status of a national symbol, the decision to have him appear on television and appeal to the nation for calm, patience, and hope coincided with the government's advice that people critical of the response should remain patient and make further sacrifices. Here, the uses of the emperor reinforce Ishihara's invocation of heaven's vengeance and his effort to lay blame and responsibility for the catastrophe on the people rather than the leadership. What the summoning of the emperor dramatized was the principal importance of the imperial institution in Japanese society. Yes, throughout all of post-war Japan. For all of the nonsense that's been written about the emperor, I think the emperor is still the most powerful single institution in Japanese society. I think it's even more powerful in the post-war period than it was in the pre-war. But what the summoning... In other words, what the summoning of the emperor dramatized was its principal importance for Japanese society, and of course the unfortunate decision of the Americans to retain it after World War II instead of hanging him, even though most people would disavow its importance if asked. That's really the important thing is, you know, most Japanese that I've spoken to, I mean, you know, when you mention the emperor, they think you're nuts and they just laugh or giggle. It is precisely this contradictory attitude which simultaneously recognizes both the irrelevance of the imperial institution and its claims, but never questions the status of the emperor and the continuation of his reign in Japanese life in the 21st century that is now being utilized by the government to prevent further disruption. Japanese who disavow the importance of the emperor in their everyday lives still act as if he were the embodiment of the national community. As the symbol and titular head of the nation, the emperor is still positioned to get people to accept the existing political arrangements, as no other institution can, by the way, no other institution. Even though it's the people, not the emperor, that constitutes the source of sovereignty. This is done by transferring the people's sentiments of loyalty toward the social community, which is the ethnic group to which they all belong, onto the politically the community or state. In other words, the emperor stands astride of both political and social community, and so it's easy to, in other words, to move from one to the other as if it was the same. They were the same communities. In this way, the emperor enables and embodies the conflation of two domains in the popular mind, which is now being persuaded to misrecognize the social, that which constitutes the ethnic group, with the form of political rule that has been constructed over them. The leadership's recent reliance on the emperor thus reflects an effort at damage control, by which I mean the attempt to constrain an angry and distrusting population from acting out their frustration and disbelief by disrupting the received arrangement of authority. At the same time, it aims to shift the burden of responsibility for the recovery away from the leadership. The transparent failure of the leadership to act decisively and reassure the population with accurate information and aid risks splitting the carefully constructed identification between popular sovereignty and political rulership. There are, as I said, a number of commentators, but nobody really wants to really do a kind of serious political analysis of the situation. The worst still are the chorus of commentators who have seen the disaster as an opportunity for hope that will bring the nation together. One writer even talked about it as reinforcing the Japanese spirit, Yamato Damashi. You know, it's stuff like that. I mean, others call into question the heroic historical accomplishments of the past, like the rebuilding of Tokyo after the earthquake of 1923 and the reconstruction of the country after war's defeat in 1945. But yet these, like most or all historical analogies, are inappropriate examples for the present and are only capable now of inducing nostalgia and misrecognition. Why don't I just end there, okay? That's fine.